shift your attention elsewhere away from the golf swing, you could free your body up to do what it knows how to do. I think there's an inner athlete in all of us, and there's that golfer on the range that everyone knows exists. You're hitting great shots on the range, and all of a sudden you're shanking them on the course. What happened? There's some disconnect there. I believe one of the reasons for that disconnect is the obsession of the swing and thinking about what your body's doing before and during the golf swing. There's internal, external, and neutral thoughts. Internal would be what your body's doing. That's what most of us default to. How are my wrists hinging? How's my shoulder turn? How are my legs moving during the swing? You can do that, but maybe one or two of those thoughts would be beneficial. Most golfers would have better results if they shift to something external, like when I'm hitting my driver, sometimes I'm just focusing on striking the center of the face. When I'm chipping a shot, I'm just trying to brush a blade of grass in front of the ball.
Hi, this is Larry Heckner in Wilmington, North Carolina. I play on the beautiful Pete Dye and Jack Nicklaus courses alongside the Atlantic Ocean at the Country Club of Landfall. Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, episode number 861.
The Four Foundations of Golf, How to Build a Game That Lasts a Lifetime, with author John Sherman.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter Podcast, John.
Fred, thank you for having me on again. It's been a while. It's been a few years, right? We were trying to reminisce on that.
Yeah, you were on episode 664, published in November of 2018. So it's been 4 years. But that's when your last book came out, right?
Yeah, your output is prodigious to have that many episodes. That's incredible.
Well, I've been doing it a long time, and I'm the kind of person that if I stop, take a break or something, I may never show up again. So I'm just terrified to stop doing it, and I love doing
habits,
it so much.
Habits are everything. But yes, I think my first book was out in like 2016, and we spoke about it maybe a couple of years after. But I appreciate the opportunity to talk about my new book, and thank you for having me on.
And your podcast,
yes.
And your website. And yeah. you talk about prodigious on episodes. You are prodigious on your content distribution. I mean, you put out a lot of content.
I'm exhausted.
Is this your primary gig? Is this what you're doing?
It is.
Exhausting yourself with golf content?
I practical golf, I'm fortunate to say, is my full-time business. But ever since I put the book out, it just took such a monumental amount of energy to finish it and get it ready and now promote it. We still do our podcast, The Sweet Spot. It's easy for me to talk about things. I think it's easier to talk than it is for
Absolutely.
Me to write.
No question about it.
Yeah. So that content is still flowing out of me because you put me in front of a microphone, I'll talk for 20 hours. But in terms of other content, I need to really get back on the horse because, as you said, the habit of you doing the podcast, I had a habit of writing, and I need to get back into it.
And is that how you came to all the? Are you a writer by?
No.
You know, what brought you to all this?
I just had, quite honestly, I had some ideas on golf. I got to be a pretty good golfer. I was tortured by the game for a long time, so I was an unhappy golfer. I figured a few things out, and I thought that I had something to offer other golfers from a player's perspective versus, what most people defer to in the game improvement community, which is consuming swing tips. So I was like, well, what about everything else? What about practicing, strategy, managing your expectations, how you're handling your emotions on the golf course? And I think the other option was kind of mental game advice. So you got swing tips and mental game advice that existed for a very long time. And I think some others have slotted in somewhere in between that. So I'm not an author or I'm not a writer. I think I'm someone who has a philosophy on golf. I'm a player coach. And I think my skill as a writer is I'm able to communicate simply to people and kind of take all the big ideas and distill it down into something simple. I think that's what I'm good at in writing. I'm not a great stylistic writer. I'm never going to write a novel, but that's why I really don't think of myself as an author, despite writing this massive book. which is kind of crazy.
You said it before I did. Massive book, to say the least.
Yeah, it's a lot.
This is the book. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Foundations of Golf and How to Build a Game That Lasts a Lifetime. And when I received it, you know, and I get books in the mail a lot, obviously, because people would like to be interviewed, and I find people and I want to talk to them about their books. I got this and I was like, oh my God. I was terrified.
What is wrong with this guy?
It's like, get a life, buddy.
You know what the crazy thing is, Fred? There could have been a lot more. I could have kept going. I had to cut myself off at one point.
Why?
Because my wife, who is a great editor and edited this whole book, wow. I just kept going. And I said to her at some point, I'm like, I have all these other ideas I can put in there, but I've got to stop at some point or else I'll keep going forever. Because I genuinely love golf. I love talking about golf. I like helping people solve problems with golf. And there are endless problems. I thought about putting a section on equipment. Like, there's just so many things to explore. But eventually I had to say, that's enough. Maybe people like yourself are going to see this thing and be intimidated by it.
Totally intimidated. But, you know, with golf equipment, they come out with new equipment every 6 months. So you'd have to revise the book every six
exactly.
months.
Exactly. 10 editions.
You know, if you can keep going, then it's 4 more foundations of golf, right?
We might end up with 20, we'll say.
Oh, 18. Come on, you got to do 18. You can't.
That's a great marketing idea. I'm going to take that from you.
It's not the first person to say, I'm going to do a book and it's 16 chapters. And I'm like, why not 18? Oh my God, what a great idea. Like, really? I'm not the first one to think of that. Come on. 18 is life, man. So I don't even know where to get going with this thing because there's so much that you do cover. But I think that I'd like to just maybe go into bits and pieces of each foundation.
Sure.
And one of the lines that you had that kind of jumped out at me, and this is in the acknowledgement, right? So I'm reading, it says, please resist the temptation to confuse knowledge with skill. And it just jumped out at me because so often I've heard people say, yeah, I saw a guy do this on TV and I'm going to do it. It's like, what? Right, just because you've seen it, you know that it exists, doesn't mean you can pull it off.
Yeah, I think I try and remind people of that throughout the book, which I guess I'm talking a little bit out of both sides of my mouth. I'm giving a lot of information, but at the same time, I'm like, you're going to have to be patient. You can't use all of this at once. I tell people maybe pick 2 or 3 topics from the book that really resonate with you and focus on them. Mm-hmm. And to get to your point about that quote is that I think, you know, golf is not necessarily a complicated game once you kind of peel back the layers and see what's going on. But once you cross that threshold to being on the course and you're in the arena, so to speak, you know it. I know it, and everyone listening to it knows, is like, it seems like everything speeds up and everything goes out the window. So everything you told yourself before the round that you're going to do is like, oh, now what? So I try and caution people that, like, for example, if I give you a very basic format on strategy, how to select targets on approach shots, it is quite simple what I describe, but you're going to say, oh, that's so easy. I'll just do that every time. But when you're in the heat of the battle, you're going to be like, oh, that one missed the green. I'm not going to do this anymore. It's the discipline and the commitment to sticking with certain things that is really the hard part. So I do want to warn people that just because you maybe digested a swing tip or some of the stuff that I talk about in the book, practice methods, strategic advice, whatever, it's not like you downloaded that into your computer and all of a sudden it's going to execute perfectly on the golf course. It just doesn't work that way. And that's why I always talk about incremental progress and patience. So that's where I stand on that, is that it's easy to consume information, but it's much harder to put it into practice during a live round of golf.
No question. No question about it. Let's start with managing expectations. We'll just touch on this. You know, here's where I want to have a question about your grandmother's golf clubs.
Yes.
Tell me that story, please. I loved reading a little bit of it, but I want to hear more.
So growing up, I played every sport, baseball, basketball, football, ice hockey, soccer, anything, tennis.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up on Long Island, about 45 minutes east of New York City, and I lived in New York City for a long time, and now didn't think I'd be back out here, but here I am. Anyway, I think I was 10 or 11 years old. I went in my grandmother's garage, and I believe they were my late grandfather's clubs. I unfortunately did not know him. Mm-hmm. Old clubs, hickory shafts, you know, old leather bag, you know, golf balls with the strange dimples on them that you see in these vintage, you know, sites now. And there's an abandoned schoolyard across the street. So I just took them. I went over there. I just started hitting shots. And
how old were you?
I think I was 10 or 11. Okay. And I think it was with the persimmon driver. I realized that I needed to stack a bunch of dead grass in the air. So I made myself a makeshift tee because there were no tees in the bag. And I just smoked one. And I felt, you know, when you strike a persimmon on the screws, truly on the screws, it was almost like an intoxicating feeling for an athlete. And I put it in the book. I've kind of been chasing that feeling ever since. So, yeah, when I made contact with that golf ball perfectly, like something happened inside of me. And I'm like, wow, I've not gotten this satisfaction elsewhere.
Oh.
That's how it all started.
And then you've milked it.
It did go well for me for a while. I've had some tough times in this game, but I think I've come full circle to where I'm happy with where I am in golf and what it's given to my life. But yeah, I think part of the reasons I wanted to be honest in the book, even in the early chapters and sharing some embarrassing stories, is that I had a lot of struggles enjoying the game as a teenager, as maybe in my early 20s. Like, I just couldn't wrap my head around what to expect from golf and what I wanted out of it. And I think a lot of people listening know intimately what that feels like. It's supposed to be this fun, great part of our life. But unfortunately, sometimes we go out there and we feel like we've wasted our day or something like that. And I don't want people to feel like that. And I feel like if I can give them some information to change their mindset going in, and so far the feedback from the book is it's doing that for a lot of people, is that now they have this newfound appreciation and mindset to go on the golf course with. First and foremost, I want you to have more fun. And of course, I want to lower your scores as well. But the fun part is what I try and focus on for sure.
Awesome. Hey, we're going to take a timeout. We'll be back right after this. Okay, I want to break into this book, The Four Foundations of Golf, How to Build a Game That Lasts a Lifetime by John Sherman, our guest. And four main sections here, obviously. Let's start with managing expectations. In one of your subplots in this, subtitles, what is a good shot?
Yeah.
That's a great question. What is a good shot?
I try and answer that question. I think it's a different answer for each player. And I'm going to leak into another chapter here as well when Please. I answer this question. But a lot of us, I grew up watching, you know, I got into golf when Tiger first started winning. So that was one of the reasons I got so obsessed with it.
Sure.
And I watched PGA Tour golf religiously, like many other golfers do. And I'm being shown this version of golf that doesn't even exist for professionals. You know, it's a kind of like a highlight reel. And that made me go on the course thinking that, oh, I'm a good iron shot is 10 feet from the pin, no matter where I am. Like, if I don't do that, then that's not a good shot. Or, you know, I'm not wedging it to 5 feet or 3 feet for a tap in par from beside the green or making a lot of putts. So I went on the course as a junior golfer. As I got better and better, I was like, where are all these shots? Where are these like pin seeking? And that was like my measuring stick. And I think a lot of golfers feel the same way. It's like they just can't wrap their heads around what is a good result. So what I try and do in the book is with the use of statistics, I'm fortunate to have access to a database of golf shots from a company called ShotScope. Mm-hmm. And they're tracking golfers' shots around the world by various handicap levels. And, you know, to explain it very simply, like my definition of a good tee shot is, did you advance it your average distance. So most golfers can drive it 220, 230. You drive it out there around your average different distance, that's a check mark. I don't even care if you don't hit the fairway. Just as long as you have a reasonably clear shot to the green with a decent lie. You satisfy those two things, I think that's a good golf shot. Because you've avoided the trouble, you've avoided fairway bunkers are huge penalties for golfers. Obviously, the trees and recovery situations, you've lost a minimum stroke there. So if you just keep the ball in play off the tee and you don't have to hit a ton of fairways, great shots. Good for you. And I think a lot of golfers use the fairway or bust mentality, and that affects their strategy as well.
Sure.
Is that that's the shot they got to hit. But I think the shots that confuse golfers the most are really approach and wedge shots. So, you know, a good shot for a 15 handicap from 150 yards. It doesn't, if it was 50 feet from the hole on the green, awesome. Even if you miss the green and you had a relatively easy chip shot and you're not short-sighted in a bunker, great result. So I try and give these benchmarks from the PGA Tour, from scratch golfers, from 10 handicaps on each part of the game. And the reaction I'm getting from a lot of people as they read the book is, oh, it's not, you know, I just had the wrong mindset. And when you can change that mindset, a few things can happen. You'll be happier because now you're actually reacting appropriately to shots that you're hitting on the course. You won't have as much pressure on yourself. You'll make better strategic decisions. So the reason I started off the book with managing expectations is because if the topics I think are the four foundations, like I think that's the foundation of the foundations. If you don't get that part of the game right, nothing else is going to fit. And most people who are coming back to me with feedback from the book, they tell me the first section is really the one that is giving them, you know, a real mindset shift on their game.
Mm-hmm. How do you, where do you put intent in this as far as when someone steps up to a shot, do they have an intention of what they want to accomplish on that? Or is it just like, oh, I'm happy with the results?
Well, I do want people to have, so in the other sections with strategy and the mental game where I'm talking about pre-shot routines and picking appropriate targets, I absolutely want you to have a very specific intention when you step up to a shot. I want you to have a process of evaluating what's around you, whether it's a tee shot, approach shot, wedge shot. I want you to be able to step up to the shot, look around, do your yardage work. Hopefully you've got a GPS watch. Make a quick decision. Say, that's my target. I know that's my target because I learned a decent framework from John in this book or maybe elsewhere. I pick my target. I go through my routine. I execute. And then I move on to the next one and accept the results. So it's all a complete package. It all works together. But I think the reaction part of it, let's say you had 100 yards to the hole in the fairway and you hit it to 20 feet. Great shot. But if you didn't know that, you might say like, oh, that was, I should have hit that 5 feet to the pin. Or maybe you were aiming at the pin because you thought you were supposed to land it near the pin. And now you've made a poor strategic decision that short sides you in the bunker. And now you make a double bogey. So it's all connected. But I absolutely want as much intention as possible because I think it allows you to execute more effectively. And more importantly, now you can pay attention to feedback. If you don't have a target, you don't know why you missed the target in your post-round analysis, which I like people to do. So intention is super important on and off the golf course, even when you're practicing. So big into intention if you didn't notice.
Big in, yeah. Oh, good. That's why I'm asking. You know what I love to do on a book like this that's so intimidating for me is just cherry pick on various topics within each section. And I'm curious about the two-thirds rule.
Yep. So I think that's one of my, I've been writing articles on my site, Practical Golf, since 2015. And this was one of the earliest, like greatest hits that I had. Mm-hmm. And I put it in the book and people who, you know, weren't followers of the site who read the book were like, again, this is a mindset shift for me. No one sat me down and explained golf to me in this way before. It was mostly just golf swing. So the two-thirds rule is, I believe there's, for simplicity's sake, there's three separate parts of golf: tee shots, approach shots, and then what I would call finesse shots 100 yards and in, which is a combination of your wedges and putter. Again, as a junior player, I thought to reach my best golf, I had to do all three of those well every round. I had to hit great tee shots, approach shots, and putting and wedge. What I realized after many, many, many rounds and getting to a fairly high level and watching other golfers at a high level is that I never saw anyone do all three phases really well, where they just like conquered golf. I've seen it on TV with Jim Furyk shot a 58, but not in person. And I realized that some of my best rounds were when one part of my game was kind of like average or below average. So, for example, I've shot under par while having great tee shots and approach shots, but not really chipping or putting that well. Oh, or I've had days where my putter was on fire and I hit great drives, but my iron game was not sharp. So I realized that I didn't need to be firing on all cylinders to play my best. So that was kind of like removing a noose from around my neck. You know, getting back to expectations, is that I didn't want to step on the course thinking that everything needed to go well, because eventually you're going to hit a bad shot. And if you don't have the right mentality, then that bad shot can send you into a tailspin mentally. You're all of a sudden you're anxious, you're angry at yourself, rather than saying like, okay, that was supposed to happen, let's move on to the next one. And another part of the two-thirds rule is that I think you can play kind of like your quote-unquote average golf with only doing one out of three things very well, and the other two are kind of like okay. And I believe the key to most players lowering their handicaps is removing those 0 out of 3 days. And that's a combination of skill development, mental fortitude, a bunch of things, because a lot of golfers just give up when things aren't going well. They say, yeah, screw it, this day's over. I've seen people give up on the round after their first tee shots because they hit one out of bounds and they're like, and then the rest of the day is kind of a nightmare. So I am trying to introduce some concepts to people that I think I like to call like your toolkit to be your own coach, so that you can avoid the 0 out of 3 days, because I think that is in most people's control. There's a lot of things in golf that are beyond our control, but if you could do one or two parts of the game fairly well, you're gonna be okay, and don't expect perfection is the big takeaway from that. And when people read that and hear that, they're like, oh, that, you know, I feel a little bit better, because again, the disaster shots are going to show up. We want to reduce as many as we can, but you watch PGA Tour players. Colin Morikawa at the end of the FedEx Cup was right in the lead, and all of a sudden I think he went from 9 under to 1 under in a span of 2 or 3 holes. He's an incredible golfer. He's one of the best in the world. He's going to be a generational golfer, and that happened to him. No one is immune from this. Golf will come for you. And it's okay. It really is. It's not the end of the world.
Right. And I think that golf is one of the best reminders we should have in life that perfection does not exist.
No.
You can't be perfect. It just doesn't happen.
It's a really hard burden to take on the course. And I played with that burden for a really long time. And I'm around a lot of golfers who place that burden on themselves. And it's a hard way to get enjoyment out of the game. And it's a hard way to actually shoot lower scores too.
Let's take another time out. We'll be right back. So how did you manage, or how did you learn to manage your expectations?
Well, I went about it the hard way. I'm ashamed to admit that I was someone who had a temper problem on the golf course for a really long time. I share a really embarrassing story in the book about being on the course with my father, breaking a club in front of him, which was really the low point. But experiences like that made
me kind of... What did your dad say? Wait, what did your dad say? Don't leave me there.
He didn't say anything. He just walked off the course in disgust, which was one of those like... I think I'm a parent now, and I think one of the stories you always hear from other or kids when the worst moment of their life is like, you get to that point like, you know, you're not being yelled at. You're just like, they just go silent, and like then you know you've hit them on this level where it's like, oh my God, I've never seen that reaction before. I tossed a club at the golf cart, broke the driver in half, and he just looked at me and walked off the course. And I shared that very early in the book just to humble myself in front of everyone and show that I was a psychopath as well. But that experience made me realize, like, you cannot continue like this. You either have to quit or you have to figure out a way to enjoy this game again. And at the time, I wasn't able to practice or play enough. So I just said, listen, you go out there and you just have fun. Don't worry. You're not the golfer you were when you were 16. You live in New York City. There's not a lot of places to practice and play. So just, you know, the 10 times a year you play, go have fun. And I tell people that in the book. If you don't have a lot of time to practice and play, like, I wouldn't really measure yourself against anything so much. So, yeah, to answer your question, is I think a lot of the mistakes that I made that I reflected upon, and of course, at this point, I've played in a lot of tournament golf with elite amateurs. I've been around a lot of beginner, intermediate golfers. So I've been paying attention to thousands of golfers for almost, you know, 25 years now, and learning from some other great coaches in the industry. And I've tried to blend all of those experiences to communicate to people, like, so they can ask these questions to themselves. The answers are different for each golfer. I want to ask questions that get people to make decisions on what they want out of the game. You want to get better? You have the time to do it and you're willing to commit? Great. I've got a ton of ideas for you. You don't want to get better? You just want to go out there and have a walk and talk to your friends and have a few beers? I think that's awesome too. That's a great way to enjoy the game as well. But you have to make that decision. You can't be the golfer like me who is stuck in between those two worlds. And I was not very happy with that. So, and it's not a permanent thing. I think our life situations dictate what we can do in golf. Some people have, you know, jobs, family obligations, and golf's not something they can commit to time-wise. So I'm just asking all these questions and trying to get people to reflect. I think that's the best way you can hopefully manage your expectations. And I try and give benchmarks, whether it's stats, scoring levels. You know, no matter how good you get at this game, you could have a 20, 30 stroke difference between your best and worst scores. People seem to not understand that. I talk about that. So yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. And I've thought long and hard about it for many years and probably will for the rest of my life. So maybe there'll be another book about this.
One of my favorite stories, and I don't know if I heard an interview or a listener, I think a listener told me this, but he said when he was playing, when he was young, he was a kid, he was playing with his dad, and he got upset and threw a club, and his dad said, "You're not good enough to throw your clubs yet."
Yeah, that's like, a great...
Whoa.
that was one of the moments I had with myself. I'm like, you're not good enough to get angry at yourself. You haven't put in enough work.
Right.
And that's... Like, my formula for happiness is the book, is when your expectation level can match your skill level. And I got angry at myself because I wasn't having the results I wanted. But when I thought about it, like, you're not practicing, you're not playing. Like, why do you deserve to shoot those scores? You don't. And that's sometimes a tough look in the mirror. But again, it's just a game, so who really cares?
Right. And I don't know if you've ever had Fred Shoemaker on or had a conversation with him, but he talks about how even the best players in the world, are they happy?
I don't think so, many of them. I really don't.
He says he'll talk to 1,000 people and ask them, you know, okay, so you're scratch golfers. How many of you are happy when you play golf? They're like,
oh, yeah, I'm around a ton of scratch plus handicaps in the tournaments I play. Mm-hmm. I would say that I know a lot of 15, 20 handicaps who are quote-unquote happier golfers than them. You know, your scoring level doesn't dictate your success or enjoyment in golf. It's just an imaginary measuring stick we have. Would we all like to play at scratch level? Yeah, but like I could tell you as a scratch golfer when my handicap got to zero, I didn't get some like envelope in the mail or like there wasn't any like great, you know, thing that happened to me. It's just like, oh, it's just a number on a screen. Like I'm proud of it. I worked really hard for it. But at the same time, like I try not to obsess over scores because I want to enjoy golf for what it is. It's just like this great game. So yeah, I'm around a ton of really good golfers who shoot in the 60s all the time. And a lot of them are miserable because they're chasing something they're never going to get. And they're never happy with it.
And what is it they're chasing? Do we know? Do they know?
They want to win tournaments. They want to beat a bunch of people. They want to, you know, they think... The problem is, I think the no man's land is kind of like the low single-digit handicap, I would say. I'm not the first person to say this. They are the most tortured golfers, in my opinion, because they see the mountaintop, they could shoot even par, but they could also shoot an 88 or a 90. So they're stuck in between these, like, the par world and then the over par world. And when I was there, it was, yeah, like 3, 4, 5, 6 handicaps. Like, those are often, like, can be very unhappy golfers because there are a wide range of outcomes. And because par is the score that we, you know, fascist. Shooting par. Yeah, that is that is the number that everyone say, oh, you shot par? Like, you're on a whole other level. So they can taste that from time to time, but it's not going to happen that often. And then they're in the 80s world or even 90s world with everyone else. So they're kind of caught between these two worlds. And that can be very frustrating for certain players. Whereas I see golfers who shoot in the high 80s and mid 90s, and they're happier than a pig and you know what.
Yeah.
Because they're just going out there and having a good time. They care about their score, but they're not. Yeah, I broke 100. I had I beat, you know, I won a Nassau off my friend, whatever. Like, that's, I'd much rather that than, you know, someone who's shot a 69. They're like, well, it could have been a 66. And you're like, oh, come on. it truly is all relative in this game. It really is. And happiness does not have to equal your score. Of course, in a perfect world, you want to be lowering your scores and having a great relationship with the game. I think that's, you know, the optimal scenario for most, but sometimes it's just not in the cards.
I had a real good round last week, and it impacted my index by not a decimal point, by a full point.
Oh yeah, that was gonna
it dropped
happen.
Down a
this.
Full point, and I'm like, oh, that's pressure.
It's yeah, like, now you've got this weight of expectation on yourself, right?
Right, and it's like, I don't like that. I'm really an anomaly here. I don't play for money. I don't compete. I don't play tournaments and stuff. I just go out because I love to play golf. And I'm playing well, but it's pressure on myself. The whole thing is pressure on myself.
Yeah, and honestly, that's why as someone who has spent a lot of my life obsessing over results on and off the golf course, I think one of the things that I try to communicate in the book is that golf is a counterintuitive game. The more you think less about your score and going through a process, having gratitude to be there, making the right strategic decisions. You know, I genuinely don't want people to even know where they stand in relation to par during their rounds because they're so involved in the experience. And whether that's having a good walk and talking with your buddies, feeling connected to the game and making decisions and, you know, going through your routine versus like, oh my God, I'm 8 over par. I'm not going to shoot an 85 today if I don't turn it around on the next 6 holes. Like, that's a much harder way to play this game. And unfortunately, that is the way most people play this game. But there is another way, but it will take a little bit of work and mindset shift.
And I'm so much on the mindset shift lately. And it's impacted my game for the better, but it feels like it's taken me 17 years of this podcast, of being a student of, like my son said the other day, he asked me about it because he was playing this exclusive course. And I'm like, not sure I know what that is. He goes, how can you not know what that course is? And I don't want to even mention it because it'll really admit
my
stupidity.
Well, you're in Northern California, right?
Well, my son's in Southern California. Yeah.
But okay. All right. Well, you've got a ton of great courses up and down your coast there. So he's like,
how do you not know this course? I said, it sounds vaguely familiar, but I'm there. She goes, but you obsess on golf. I said, no, I obsess on golf instruction. that's what the podcast is about. That's where I do my obsessing on. And it's like, I don't know. I'm going to take another time out and figure out where. We'll be back after this. All right, I need to skip right to section 4. I've got to go to section 4, the mental game.
Do whatever you need to do.
Been talking a lot about, and you know, golf smarter, that's what it is. It's managing your expectations, managing your strategy, managing the course. And it's just, you're just, when you play better, when you play smarter, right? And, I'm part of a conversation we've been having a lot lately is talking about what you should think about while you're swinging. And I'm curious what your approach is on this in, section 4.
The mental game. Yeah, one of the, the concepts that I ultimately the mental, or my version of the mental game in the book, is building up to what I think is a successful slash productive pre-shot routine. And one element of that is, what are, I mean, we can't completely control our brains. I don't want to give that impression, but we can shift our attention. And, you know, getting back to my original point when we first started the show, is that when most people get into the game, everything's about the swing. And it, you know, and rightfully so. The golf swing is very important. You've had a lot of great instructors on this show. We know how important instruction is and the technical elements of the golf swing. However, if you bring all of, again, knowledge is not skill, if you're consuming 50 YouTube videos about swing theory and listening to 10 different coaches, if you're reading every book ever written on the golf swing, you are not making yourself a better golfer. You're making yourself a more confused golfer, in my opinion. So when it gets to game time and execution, I believe to have success in golf, it needs to be similar to other sports. You need to be in this reactive autopilot state. When I play basketball or any other sport, I'm reacting to an opponent. I don't have time to think about what my jump shot is, what my elbow's doing, or, you know, how I need to rotate my trail forearm when throwing a ball to the first baseman. There's no time for that. You're reacting and you're executing. Unfortunately, golf is a game of initiating contact, so you have time to think about all these things. And I believe if you could shift your attention elsewhere away from the golf swing, you could free your body up to do what it knows how to do. I think there's an inner athlete in all of us, and there's that golfer on the range that everyone knows exists. You're hitting great shots on the range, and all of a sudden you're shanking them on the course. What happened? There's some disconnect there. I believe one of the reasons for that disconnect is the obsession of the swing and thinking about what your body's doing before and during the golf swing. So I offer some alternative solutions. I certainly got help from my podcast co-host Adam Young on this. We call them, you know, he kind of identifies them as a locus of attention, or there's a few different ways you could call it, but there's internal, external, and neutral thoughts. Internal would be what your body's doing. That's what most of us default to. How are my wrists hinging? How's my shoulder turn? How are my legs moving during the swing? You can do that, but maybe one or two of those thoughts would be beneficial. I believe most golfers would have better results if they shift to something external, like when I'm hitting my driver, sometimes I'm just focusing on striking the center of the face. When I'm chipping a shot, I'm just trying to brush a blade of grass in front of the ball. You can hear pro golfers talk about this. Rory McIlroy got quoted as saying when he hits an iron shot, he's just thinking about bottoming out the club in front of the ball. These are ways to get your mind to self-organize around a task versus thinking about how you do it. Do you like darts, Fred?
No, I'm not a darts player.
Do you ever play catch in your life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Have you ever thought about what your elbow's doing while you're throwing the baseball or football?
No, only if it hurts.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I always found odd about golf, is even broadcasts about golf. We watch basketball games and football games. Are we looking at Tom Brady's wrist angles when he's throwing a touchdown? Are we looking at Steph Curry's jump shot on the Konica Minolta BizHub slow motion thing? No.
Well, yeah, actually with Steph Curry, they're like talking about his form and his release point and his speed. And yeah, yes, but.
But not, it doesn't dominate the broadcast.
Right, exactly. It's, yeah. Like, wow, what a shot.
Exactly.
How did golf, he do that?
Yeah, golf is different with the broadcast, but they stopped to say, like, let's see what happened differently on that shot. I guarantee you, if you showed 50 videos of Rory McIlroy's driver swing, you wouldn't be able to identify the minutiae which caused them to hit it 20 yards to the right.
They, well, that's also because of the technology that they have, these high definition super slow-mo cameras that they can show a, you know, the granules of sand exploding off the club. The technology, yep, allows that, so they got to fill that with chatter.
Exactly. So I think what that does is, again, well, we all watch, we're thinking golf swing, golf swing, golf swing. What are my hands doing? And right, there is another way. And I think, you know, neutral thoughts are like humming a song, breathing deeply. Like when I'm on the putting green now, part of my pre-shot routine, and I apologize to other people who have heard me on other podcasts at this point. I say this over and over again. I'm humming songs to myself during my pre-shot routine when I putt. That gives me a lot of, when I play in tournaments and pressure's on, I'm not really hemming and hawing if I'm going to make or miss the putt. I just figured out this little zone I can put myself into that's kind of comfortable for me. I go through it every time, and I just try to live with the results. Of course, I want the putts to go in, but I have to accept when they don't. And a lot of that has to do with me not thinking about my putting stroke. Because I'm confident on the work I've put in off the course that I can identify the speed and the break and all that stuff. I've done that work. And when I'm on the course, I'm just trying to be an athlete like I was in other sports. Not that I'm some phenomenal athlete, but I think there is an athlete in all of us. And that instinct is there. We just have to let it out a little bit more. And I think one of the ways to do that is to stop thinking about the damn golf swing all the time.
Right.
And that's hard to do. And you have to identify things that work for you that you can focus on elsewhere. But I want at least people, introduce people to that concept.
Right. Right. And I'm curious that, have you, a couple episodes ago, we had Gabriel Wolf, Rebecca Luthwaite, who are biokinesiology professors and been studying this for, you know, decades. And it's now, you know, what you're thinking of, you know, what my thought is, it's actually science that if you have external thoughts during your swing, you'll have more success.
Yeah, I'm not the first person to figure this out.
Right, exactly.
No way.
If you, they now have science, but if you think internally, you're going to screw things up. And it's like, oh, so to me, it was like, oh, so that's why to be a good golfer, you have to be 6 years old, you know, start when you're 6 years old. You have to, you know, you can't do this because they just let it go. They just swing. And it's really had a huge impact on me, my game, how, my approach to everything.
Well, I think it removes a burden from a lot of people. Because again, as golfers, it's part of the culture of golf. You're at the range hitting balls. There's been times guys come up to you, they say, oh, I saw you doing this. Amateur swing doctors everywhere. Like all we talk about is the swing. You know, we're trying one swing tip one week and another swing tip another. The industry markets itself this way because the golf swing is easy to package up and sell as well. And I'm not, I do want to make this point is that I'm not against swing instruction. I have a whole chapter in the book where I talk about why I think you should work with an instructor and best practices. But my point is that you need to stick with that one voice for continuity and relevancy versus chasing all these tips and these pieces of a golf swing puzzle that don't fit in yours. And when you bring that out on the course, again, it's that moment right before you hit the shot. I played golf a long way, you know, worrying about my swing, whereas now I do my best to, I'm behind the ball, I identify my target, I select it, I go through my physical routine that is exactly the same, I do my rehearsals, and I step up to the ball, and I hit. And I'm not allowing enough time or thought to get in there and be like, don't do this with your hands. Not saying that never happens to me, but I found a much higher level of golf when I've been able to initiate some type of autopilot. And of course, there's a ton of other mental coaches out there that have spoken about, you know, the benefits of some type of rehearsal before a shot. I really do believe it's beneficial. And one of the elements of that is deciding what you're trying to think about and focus on.
Listen, I'm going to take a quick time out. We'll be right back right after this. This week on Golf Smarter Mulligans, it's the second of two conversations with Brady Wilson about the course he works at in Palm Desert. This property has a very unique identifier that you won't hear many course GMs talking about with this source of pride.
We did 5,474 tournament rounds. And of those... And we're going to do more than that this year. That's quite a bit of tournament rounds. So we went up in tournament rounds when a lot of people were going down. We get a lot of groups that want to play here. Of those rounds, the ones that were for pure charitable were 2,660, somewhere in that ballpark. So, you know, we were almost half or a little bit more than half were completely charitable rounds where people were using it as a fundraiser to create money for a local charity. And if you figure out what we charged them versus what our rack rate was during those times, the charitable donation part that we took off of those rounds was over $223,000. So the idea is we really are in the business of helping charities help themselves.
That's Golf Smarter Mulligan's 177 in an episode we call A Course Dedicated to Helping Charities Help Themselves, featuring Brady Wilson. Now, since this was a members-only episode back in 2011, it's the first time I'm ever sharing it publicly. So don't miss this incredible story that's being released this Friday. You may be aware that Golf Smarter is the longest-running golf podcast out there. And most of the episodes that we have just aren't available anymore, but they're as special and informative today as they were when they were originally published. That's Golf Smarter Mulligans from wherever you listen to your podcasts. I remember I played with a guy once who said, you know what I want for this Christmas? I said, what's that? He says, two good shots in a row. You know, everyone's talking about consistency. And I think that the fact that we tinker all during a round and we keep making changes and we're like, oh, I can fix that. Oh, I'm doing this today, so I'm going to try to compensate for that. That you're putting yourself in a position where you can't be consistent.
Yeah, I think there's...
Trust your stuff.
There's a double-edged sword in golf where it's you have to allow for the natural variance of the game to happen. You know, if you hit one tee shot to the right and one tee shot to the left, I wouldn't say that's enough information to make an adjustment. But the coaching I try and do, you know, we don't have time to really dive into the practice section here, but I'm trying to get people to develop ball striking skills, not technical skills, meaning can you strike the center of the face? Can you control where the golf club is pointing at impact? So that when you see these things on the course, you say, okay, that ball curve from right to left, I know why that happened because I understand the ball flight laws. And I'm not just going to come up with some nonsense golf swing thing where I'm going to try and hinge my wrists a little more vertically. I understand why that happened, and I'm paying attention to feedback and practice. And I think there's solutions for every golfer that are different. So for me, for example, if I notice that I'm leaving all my shots to the right, I know my club face is too open at impact. I have an adjustment I can make that I've worked on in practice to help mitigate that, perhaps not solve it, but I'm not going to be doing that all round long, like going back and forth like between these things. I'm looking for patterns, and if I see there's a problem, then I'm going to make an intervention. So that is a very difficult... We talk about that a lot on the Sweet Spot, Adam Young and myself, is... When do you intervene and when do you just understand what is just the variance of golf? That's a topic for another podcast. Yeah. But it's
that's why
it
can
get complex. Yeah, it can get complex. Yeah. But you know, there's little adjustments we all can make. I don't want, like what you said before, I don't want people like changing their swing in the middle of the round. Like that's not gonna solve it.
No, no. And, you know, again, it's not about hitting a ball. It's about a golf swing, right? I was playing with some people the other day, and they were clearly a couple times a year golfers or maybe just starting to play after not playing for a long time. And I just said, I'm not going to offer you any instruction. I'm not positioned to do that. I'm just curious. Where do you think the club, the bottom of your, you know, if the swing is a circle, where's the bottom of the circle in relation to the ball? And every time I ask that question, people say, yeah, about 2-3 inches behind the ball. It's like, mm-mm. That's the only instruction I'm going to give you right now is no.
It's the other way.
It's on the front edge of the ball. They're like, how is that possible? It's like, I don't know, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, Adam Young has some great images like that on his website about low point control and arc depth. It can get a little esoteric, but when some people see that circle and they see his visualizations, which I think are brilliant, of an iron swing and you're like catching it on the downswing, but the club is actually, at its lowest point in relation to the golf ball in front of the ball, not behind it, because that's when the chunks and the skulls start happening.
Right.
Those types of visualizations can be profound for certain golfers. For others, maybe they shouldn't even think about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's interesting about the game is you try and look for concepts that resonate with you and give you some type of framework to use on or off the golf course, and you gravitate towards those. But yeah, that circle, exactly. If you polled 100 golfers and asked them, where's the circle? Some would say like right on the ball, behind the ball. It's like, well, in terms of the physics, that's just not true for good ball strikers.
Right. Right. Promote Adam Young's YouTube channel for me.
Just search Adam Young everywhere.
There you go.
he's everywhere.
And so your podcast, The Sweet Spot. Yes.
So Adam and I co-host a show called The Sweet Spot, where me and him geek out on these topics for like 90 to, we recorded an episode Monday night on the difference between club path and swing direction. We spoke for 3 hours. We'll split it up into two episodes, but we're for the golfer who, we try and give simple explanations to complex topics, but just the way him and I are wired, we will talk about it for a long time just to, again, we're just trying to get enough ideas out there that someone listening to it, like maybe 1 5-minute segment, would be like, oh, that part really resonates with me. Now I can bring that to practice and out on the course. Because I know that if, you know, thankfully we have a decent amount of people listening to us, I know that one singular thing will not translate well to every single golfer. And that's the same way I try and communicate in the book. I'm trying to give different versions of the same message. And all you need are two or three big light bulb moments, and then you can take that info and really make some strides in your game. So we try and give those out, but it does take a long time, unfortunately. The people seem to listen in. So yeah, it's called The Sweet Spot.
And it's a very popular podcast, and I'm sure that my small audience here knows all about your podcast, because yours is much bigger. Congratulations.
Well, if they hear me talk, you ask me a question, it takes me 7 minutes to answer it, they might realize that the show's not for them.
Well, that's what I love about this podcast. I can just throw out a question and not talk for the next 10 minutes. And then
exactly.
I come back and say, we'll be back right after this.
Well, we feel the same way when we have guests on who have, you know, we try and bring in people who have expertise that we don't. And the pressure is definitely off. Like, obviously, I want to ask good questions, and so does Adam. But, like, yeah, those are the easier episodes for sure, because I'm not on the hook to fill up 90 minutes. I might only get 10 minutes in, so I'm with you there.
Yep, absolutely. And the book, again, and I'll put a link in the show notes for today's episode. It's The Four Foundations of Golf, How to Build a Game That Lasts a Lifetime by John Sherman. Check it out. And it's not just words, there's images. So
I will make a final plea to you and your listeners. I've had a decent amount of people read the book at this point. It is a long book. There's no question. I wrote 92,000 words, but
oh my gosh,
it took me 8 years to get good at a writing style that's easy to digest. So I've had a lot of people who've read the book in a few days, and it goes down pretty smooth. And you don't have to read the entire thing. Each chapter is its own little lesson.
Yeah.
I think they build together to a larger idea towards the end of each section, but don't be afraid by the length of it. And you can get it. Most people can get it on Amazon anywhere around the world, and it's available on Apple and Barnes & Noble as well online.
And your website is practical-golf.com.
That's right. And my site is practical-golf.com. I've had a ton of articles on there. And you can, I'm very active on Twitter. If you want to chat with me, you can find me at practicalgolf.
See, and he's a writer, so he says practical-golf, and I'm just like a web guy. It's like practical-golf.
Well, I mean, the only reason that has is because some guy was squatting on that domain and held it hostage for me. So I'm like, I'm not going to pay you for practical golf. I'll just do practical-golf. You can call it dash. I don't care. some guy in the UK was asking for thousands of dollars from me, so I refused to give it to him.
Good for you.
But you know what? That's his business, so fine. Right. Go for it.
But the way I say it, people probably go practical, P-R-A-C-T-I-C-A-L D-A-S-H.
Yeah.
It's
an actual hyphen, people.
It's an actual hyphen. John, it was so great to have you back on the show. And
thank you.
Congratulations with the book and best of luck with all your endeavors.
Appreciate it, Fred. Thanks so much.
I want to thank Larry Heckner from Wilmington, North Carolina, for introducing today's episode. It's just that easy to become a Golf Smarter ambassador. All you have to do is tell your friends about Golf Smarter. But if you would like a free gift as well, then just leave a voicemail introducing an upcoming episode. So please join the team, send me an email asking to do the episode opening, and I'll send you some very simple instructions and give you the choice of Tony Manzoni's Lost Fundamental video or a glove and glove storage compartment from RedRoosterGolf.com, where you can choose from 11 different styles of gloves in 26 sizes. And those styles are changing rapidly. There always seems to be adding new ones, so it might not just be 11 anymore. Larry's already received his new glove from Red Rooster Golf, so why don't you do the same? Just write to golfsmarterpodcast@gmail.com or click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.